Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and I'm joined today with a tall and bearded Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you?
Good, good, Nicholas. How's it, man?
Pretty good. I see you are stressed, but that's probably a good thing because it means you might be coming up with a new exciting campaign to take onto the national stage. And currently cameraless because his camera appears to have malfunctioned just before the show. The Lion of Benoni, the Son of the East, Mr. Marius Root. Marius, how are you?
How's it, guys?
That was very low energy, Marius.
You need to put a lot of effort into your voice work, Marius, because now
I'm worried about my camera, and I'm angry after our argument before the show.
Yes, but let's not dwell on that too much and go on to our first story for today, which we will try to make as interesting as possible. And that is the GDP figures are out for the first quarter of 2021. And of course, these are quite important because we had the massive economic contraction during 2020, the biggest, I think, Gabriel will correct me, ever or at least since the Second World War. So the quarter-on-quarter growth was, I think, 1.4%, but there's an annualized growth rate of 4.6%. It looks like finance, mining, and trade drove most of the GDP growth, and also household spending was a bit more higher than usual, especially on things like insurance, clothing, retail stuff, furniture, that sort of thing. So, Gabriel, let me start with you. Firstly, is this good news? Is this bad news? I do see that StatsSA says that the South African economy is still 2.7% smaller than it was in the first quarter of 2020.
What that's 3.3.
Oh, 3.3, yeah. Sorry. What should we take away from this? And why is mining doing so well in particular?
Well, mining's doing well because not everyone locked down like a fool. And in particular, in the Far East, production has continued to grow through 2020. That's looking both at the countries that had no lockdown, like South Korea, Japan, Singapore, Malaysia, really mostly, and Vietnam, which had a three-week lockdown. And also China, which did a heavy lockdown, but did it quite quickly and extremely brutally. We sort of did the in-between approach of very stupid and very long lockdown. Anyway, consumer growth in the Far East and manufacturing growth has driven increased demand for commodities, which is good for the mining sector because prices have gone up. Also, there's a lot of worry about dollar inflation because the US has printed sort of over $6 trillion just in the last year. And so people are worrying about hedging against sort of devaluation of the dollar, which we've seen vis-a-vis the Rand already, are interested in buying commodities, and that's also had an upward impact. We see the global economy, one way of checking where things are really going is the oil price, which has pierced the Brent crude, has pierced $70, which is basically an infinite amount higher than it was in the depths of winter last year, because the future price had dropped below zero. But in real terms, it's about twice as high. So the world is getting going again. People are burning energy. They're making things. They're using things. And so South Africa's economy is ticking up a little bit. What's very important to bear in mind over the next few years is the difference between quarter-on-quarter growth, which South Africa, I mean, we've had so little quarter-on-quarter growth in the last decade that, you know, it seems very exciting to say this quarter the economy was bigger than the last. The thing that you must track is the difference, firstly, between where the economy was in the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, and where it is now, and it's substantially lower. And SARB's, the South African Reserve Bank's projections still have it at sort of finally equalizing in 2024. So that's not looking good. And that is much slower than most economies. And the second thing is to look at the real GDP, that's to say GDP per capita in non-inflation dollar adjusted terms, or take some neutral basket. And there we are, 2011, 2012 was the peak. We slid ever since. We slid through Ramaphosa's era. We had two technical recessions. And to get back to that peak on the current numbers looks like it's won't happen in the 2020s. So the last decade is really the last two decades, because you go down and take so long to get back up that by the end of, by 2030, you end up being where you were in real terms in 2011. That is two decades lost, and that will happen short of major reform. Now, there's one more detail to get into. And I know these numbers can seem abstract and meaningless. And it, in particular, can seem strange when you sort of compare us to Germany, which is 3% lower than where it was at the start of 2020, which is to say it's in the same place we are. You know, year on year, a drop of 3% thereabouts. Here's a major difference. Germany's savings rate is up. You see the same thing in America, where they printed all the money. Very rich countries that just gave away the money. People were locked at home. They couldn't go to the cinema or to the discotheque where Marius likes to party. And so they just put the money in the bank. That's very nice, because it means that once things get going, they have excess money to spend. And we see, America looks like it's going to be getting back to its pre-COVID levels in this quarter. Brazil has already returned to its pre-COVID levels. So countries that had extraordinary lockdowns and tight contractions where people were managed to save, they can then spend their way into a boom. And America really looks like it's having the biggest boom out of a brief recession on record. It's amazing. And it's a bit worrying in its own way, but it is what it is. We are in a completely different situation to those countries for two reasons. One is that in the build-up to the plague, South Africa's savings rate was just about one of the lowest in the world. So public savings, there was some. And that just meant the government failing to spend money or steal it fast enough to count it as spending. But private savings were at about 10% per annum. By some measures, 15%. And that's lower than the world average of 25% and much lower than average of some emerging markets that are our peer countries. But if you disambiguate private savings into corporate private savings and private savings, it's another story. Corporate private savings made up basically all of non-government savings during Ramaphosa's tenure before the plague. If you look beyond that to the total net wealth, so, you know, what's the whole stock? It actually contracted in 2019. So you have this very dire circumstance where people have been struggling to save money. The only way that they could save money is if they've managed to buy stocks in companies and then the companies save the money, where it's too hard to steal. But in terms of just sort of private savings in the traditional sense, we've had almost none of that. We've had, in fact, contractions in real wealth. So when you're going in with no padding and then you hit the plague and you don't have a government that can afford to really dole out trillions of rands, so you don't get new savings. In fact, you get contractions in earnings because of 1.3 million jobs that have been lost between now and this time last year. You have the worst of all worlds. You have no money to spend your way into new growth, and you have no sort of real expectations because of the policy screw-ups of generating the kind of investor-friendly climate that will grow the jobs and manufacturing capacities needed to then generate new savings. So in this sense, the outlook is extremely dire, and the sort of brief uptake of saying, well, we're not completely as bad as we were 3 months ago is, it's good news in the very most limited of senses. And if you get a small sense of perspective, you'll see that we are really in just about the worst position of any country that's been struck by the plague. And in particular, the plague of irrational and overlong lockdowns.
Right.
With no vaccines to get us out.
Yeah. So as we can see, I think until last Sunday, we seem to be vaccinating almost no people on a Sunday, which seems to not really be taking that whole thing too seriously. But anyway, one of the shocking things to me, and you mentioned at the beginning of your point there, Gabriel, is how much so many economies around the world have actually spent on COVID relief. So you talked about the US spending $6 trillion. Well, in inflation adjusted terms, that's $2 trillion more than the US spent on World War II. And all told, apparently the US has spent an inflation adusted dollar, something like $7.9 trillion on warfare since World War I. So COVID has cost almost a century of war, which is quite something. I don't think there's, there really isn't anything like it in our time. Maurice, your thoughts. Firstly, you know, what's your take on this? Is it as bleak as you think Gabriel is saying? Can you regale us with the greatest hits of what we might need to do to get out of this mess?
Well, this isn't too surprising that we've seen this fairly decent economic growth. But, I mean, Gabriel mentioned it, and I mean, the kicker is the economy itself is still 3% smaller than it was at the end of 2019. So we're still behind where we were in 2019, and who knows how long it'll take to get to where we were then. I mean, Gabriel also made the point about the per capita incomes. I mean, we're lower than we were in 2011, and we're actually also lower than the average global citizen. At the beginning of the 90s, we were slightly richer than your average global citizen. Now we're probably about 25 to 30% poorer than your average global citizen. And, you know, it's not that isn't just because of poor policy in South Africa, it's because other countries have also had growth inducing policies and so on. But also tells you something that South Africa's been basically standing still and going backwards in a lot of ways. And I don't see much of a change. We've seen the current government is not all that interested in policies to actually get economic growth going. It's more about redistribution and whatever. I mean, we spoke on the show last week, Nick, about the Burger King acquisition, which was blocked because the people who wanted to buy it weren't the correct skin color or the correct nationality. Because actually that Equity Partners that was they wanted to buy Burger King, it's mainly invested in by Africans, African Development Bank and African pension firms and so on, but because they're not South African, they also couldn't invest, and because they weren't black. So that's all. And we also saw today, which we're going to talk about now, about the clover issue. So, I mean, there's so many things in South Africa that are making the economy, that are hobbling the economy, from policies, from crumbling infrastructure, from, things such as, labor relations to crime. South Africa, the World Economic Forum does these surveys and asks companies in different countries, what is the major issue facing your business? Crime is almost number one for every company that gets surveyed in South Africa. So that also tells you that goes back to, the state, which is not it's not really a capable state anymore. And so these are all symptoms of that. It's a state that simply doesn't know what it's doing. I wouldn't call South Africa a failing state, but I think we're definitely a flailing state at the moment. And there's lots of things we can do to get things on track again. I mean, we've spoken about this before. You know, deregulate the labor market, get rid of race-based policy, cut red tape where possible, And I mean, I'm not a libertarian when it comes to this. I'm not saying that we should, completely, there must be any regulation of businesses or anything at all. But I mean, I do think there are far too many hoops that businesses have to jump through in South Africa. And I mean, South Africa, there's so much low-hanging fruit that we can do to change things, but the government is so hogtied by ideology, I'm not sure we'll see that happen anytime soon. Unless we get to a point, and I mean, this isn't even guaranteed, where reality actually meets ideology. A good example is how apartheid ended in South Africa, or how the Indian economy decided to liberalize in the early 90s as well. But I think we could get to a position where politicians take ideology over reality. I mean, we could get to a point where the South African state is completely broke, but instead of working out ways to get the economy growing, we start printing money, which will be a disaster. And I don't think that's completely impossible.
Right. And of course, we don't have all of the stuff behind us like the US does
just one point. I mean, in 2007 and 2008, when we had the global financial crisis, South Africa had quite a lot of ammo, actually. That's because the state had been run fairly well. Natural Emanuel had run a budget surplus and so on. So we actually had quite a lot of ammo to deal with the global financial crisis. We all know what happened after that and how the States was, I mean, you know, when they went to open the cupboard and was pretty bare.
Right, indeed. Anyway, this is obviously the big story in South Africa, because if the economy doesn't grow, then the nation is going to be stuck in the doldrums. The only thing I'd add to that, you sort of did mention a little bit there, Maurice, is fixing the police force, which is currently not so good. And how can we forget, don't drag a steak knife across the Bill of Rights by abolishing the right to private property. that's always a good idea to grow economic performance. Anyway.
Yeah. If I can say one thing about that, I mean, there's just in terms of the fact that South Africans have not been able to save money has put us in a position where a lot of South Africans had to borrow money and now can't pay that money back. So TransUnion has just come out with some data about debt delinquencies up. Just in South Africa, sort of for some banks, they're looking at 30% of their repayments are not coming through. This is, you guys mentioned the global financial crisis. South Africa's banks have been downgraded into debt, into sort of junk status, our private banks, 2 or 3 times now. They are sitting in a very precarious position. And if you undermine property rights right now, you really could sort of send them over the edge. So a lot of people are buying homes. A few of my friends have actually just in the last year, because there's low interest rates. So the Reserve Bank is trying to do what it can to keep the private lending sector afloat. But between the fundamentals of the economy being extremely weak and the protection of private property being weakened, I think that it's a very dangerous space to be in South African financial services right now.
Definitely, definitely. So let us move on to a more specific example of perhaps why the economy is not growing so much. And that is news from Clover, the big dairy company in South Africa. So Clover has announced that it is closing down South Africa's largest cheese factory, which is in Lichtenburg in the northwest. It says that this is due to ongoing poor service delivery by the local municipality. It's moving its plant still within South Africa to Queensburg and Durban, where it already has a factory. It says that the Durban municipality, the eThekwini municipality, has, quote, proven to be supportive. However, their attempts to speak to the municipality, which is the Distolobha municipality, have proven fruitless. The municipality has given them the runaround, they say, when it comes to restoring electricity and water supplies to the factory, which, of course, are very important for the manufacture of cheese and the pasteurization of milk. They say that these things have been really hitting their production hard and that they have to move now because they just can't keep manufacturing there. So, as we know, I've long maintained the Northwest, it's not a great province. Outside of the mines, there really isn't that too much going on there. And this kind of seems like another blow to South Africa's rural economy. Morris, your thoughts?
Yeah, and that's, what you were mentioning earlier, crumbling infrastructure. And, it really has a real effect on economies and then by extension people. I mean, because what's been happening to Botla, now obviously they're going to close down this factory. That means 330 people are going to lose their jobs. Let's say conservatively, each of those people has 2 dependents. That means nearly 1,000 people now. And they're now being conservative. Can be far higher than that. 1,000 people now are going to be without any form of support or income or whatever the case is. And it's, as I said, this is all this low-hanging fruit stuff. You know, just run the place properly. Don't steal the money. You know, pay the money over to Eskom. Make sure the infrastructure, the water infrastructure works. Go pave the roads and so on. Now, nobody's asking for smart cities or bullet trains. You know, just go resurface the road every couple of years and make sure that the pump at the water station works satisfactorily. And I mean, this definitely isn't a limit to Lichtenberg. Astral Foods, a couple of years ago, it was at Lekwa municipality that actually had to take them to court to make sure that they would supply water. I think it was just water, but it was being electricity to their operation there. And it's also not just companies that have done this. We've seen what happened. I think it's Malutia Pofong is the municipality, Harry Smith. I think just on the border of the Free State and KZN. I mean, the people there have gone to court. Also, Kretling, Refuge Municipality, also in Northwest, people there also had to go to court to get the municipalities just to provide, you know, basic services. So, you know, we can, it's one of these issues where a poor state or a state that's not being run properly and corruption has real effects on people. As I say, because this Dipsa-Botla municipality has been run so poorly, 330 people are going to lose their jobs and however many dependents. And this is not, yeah, this is treasure, but it's been reflected around the country. And I mean, we have local government elections coming up in October. You know, let's see how, if these places do get punished. But it seems to be there's some sort of a inverse correlation between places that are run very poorly and ANC votes. You know, a place that's run very badly, the ANC seems to do very well. So it's obviously there's something strange going on there. But yeah, we'll see. I mean, I'm not too hopeful that the ANC is going to get another bloody nose in October as like it did in 2016. But let's see what happens.
Gabriel, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the political implications that Mario's gestured at there are very interesting. The, you know, there's sort of two abstract political science theories, and one is that people will vote their interests. And so a government that does well will, you know, party that does well in government will get greater reward and vice versa. And the other theory is that when governments really fail, they manage to inculcate a kind of really bad attitude. And they use fear and intimidation. They rely on sort of uneducated populations, on patronage, handouts, very low level sort of voter bribing with sort of a few t-shirts and sandwiches just before the time and the like. And so that actually the worse it does, the more popular it becomes. Now, we've seen both in South Africa. We have seen the ANC in the 2000s and the 90s really roll out piped water, electricity, paved roads, new schools, new, extra jobs, a growing GDP at 5%, all the good stuff coming together. And with that, the ANC's support growing. Nelson Mandela was by far not the most popular ANC leader. Thabo Mbeki did much better. I think now we're seeing the inverse. And yeah, so it's always good to remember that these theories are often both true and not true, because in different contexts, you get different kinds of responses. And it is up to opposition political parties to make this point in a serious and practical way that persuades people to make a change. I think it's also just worth noting that the idea of Clover moving its factory seems to me very much an afterthought. It looks a lot like what's really happened is it's closed its factory and it's going to pull some of the hardware into other places that it's already stationed. It's already got big operations, a fairly recently acquired one in Middelburg, towards Durban, another one in Durban. Look out for, if you want to get a sense of the, is this a move, then they'll be hiring another 330 workers in KZN. And if that was their plan, I think they already would have announced it. So I think what really is going on is that they're shifting their machinery, but not much more than that. For the farmers that are based in the Northwest, the fact that the largest cheese factory in the country is now closing down is going to mean that it's all the more difficult for them to supply their goods, because a huge part of dairy costs in particular, because you're moving so much volume. Milk is not that valuable, especially unpasteurized milk. So there's very heavy costs per unit, kilogram, in terms of moving it to the pasteurization center. If they're going to have to move it to Gauteng or something like that, it's going to could drive a lot of them out of business. So yes, 300 workers, maybe that means 1,500 dependents, but then there's also all of the people that are further up the supply chain to take into consideration, mm-hmm. and we'll see what that does. The final thing to say is that the Northwest is a very, very poorly run province. And in terms of this sort of broader view of South Africa, it's important to bear in mind that at this stage, 2% about of South Africa's mineral wealth is generated out of Gauteng. Although we live in the city of gold, Igoli, we really don't work like that anymore. Most of the new mineral wealth that's been created or tapped into in the last couple of decades has been in the Northwest province. It should have been part of South Africa's great booming economy, but exactly where you've seen the easiest access to new wealth, you've also seen the greatest levels of corruption, fraud, mismanagement, and decrepitation, if that's a word, which supports a very old story about the resource curse. The thought that if it's very easy to pull wealth out of the ground, then politicians keep it and people suffer.
Right. No, that's a very good point. And I think it's possibly the darkest vision for South Africa that we become a lot more like DRC or Nigeria in the way that their economies are, these kind of resource extractive things. Right. So let us move on to our last story for today. And this one is quite wild and quite interesting. And I'm not sure if I fully understand it, but basically a number of police authorities around the world from various countries, Australia, New Zealand, various countries in Europe and the United States, say that they have conducted what they are calling the world's most sophisticated sting operation on various criminal organizations around the world. That has resulted in hundreds of arrests in Australia, 224, and so many others in other countries. And the idea here, as far as I understand it, is that these crime-fighting agencies introduced apps and phones and things into these criminal organizations, convinced the leaders of these criminal organizations that these apps and phones would keep their information secure and be unable to be read, while in reality, the law enforcement agencies were reading all of their information. And so now they have 3 years worth of incriminating messages between these groups, and they have now swooped in to arrest a huge number. They say that they've gotten an Australian fugitive drug boss who was on the run in Turkey. I think he was the point of entry where they first introduced the phones, and criminals adopted them because senior criminal figures endorsed them. Pretty wild story. Gabriel, what should we make of this?
Yeah, the proof of the pudding's in the eating, in the sense that the number of convictions, the number of people that actually go to jail. You know, if 15,000 people go to jail around the world because of this amazing, longstanding sort of phone sting operation, then I think it's going to be very hard to look the gift horse in the mouth and say anything but well done to the law enforcement officers who managed to get bugged phones into the mafia's hands. On the other hand, I think people have very good reasons to be suspicious of governments spying on people. Because they don't always spy on crooks in the proper sense of the word. Sometimes they spy on very good people that are just, their only misdeed is that they oppose the government. Julian Assange is sort of, I don't know, different people have different views of him. Certainly a kind of cause célèbre for some. But another way of thinking about this is that every single American has been wiretapped in some form or another, according to the best evidence available at some point or another. So I think that, people also have a reason to worry about this kind of movement towards an Orwellian universe where the government has got a back door into your cell phone and can listen to everything that you say. If they could hear what Marius and I were talking about before this podcast started, maybe they'd try and use it against us.
And Marius, your thoughts just to close off.
Don't have much to add, but apparently this whole thing was cooked up over a beer by Australian and British police intelligence guys. So they're just sitting there, you know, shooting the breeze, and then they thought, yeah, this will be a good idea. Let's see if it works. And it seemed like it did work. So, yeah, maybe I think sometimes when it comes to crime, they're not always sending their best, the criminals. And maybe this was one of those instances. So, but I think Gabriel's right. Obviously, the governments do actually need sometimes the ability to, you know, listen to people. But we've got to be very careful about, you know, there's a saying that if you don't have anything to be worried about, then you won't worry about the government watching you. I mean, I disagree with that. So the government does need certain powers, but we have to be very careful about government overreach and so on. I mean, we've seen what's happened in the post-COVID world where lots of the governments taken, or governments around the world have taken a lot of powers they didn't have before. And it's going to take, I think, a lot to get those governments to give up those powers. And this is one of those. I mean, the United States also did it after 9/11, you know, with lots of overreach and restrictions on civil liberties, you know, to stop terrorism in inverted commas. So it's also the one of those things, I think. Yeah, I mean, somebody's got to watch the watches as well.
Right, right. I think what makes me sleep a bit easier about this is that it seems as though these phones were only basically available on the black market. They were very specifically set up to make it look like they were for encryption only. They couldn't do other things like send emails and SMSs. And so it wasn't quite the same as them tapping normal phones as for example, the National Security Agency's done in the US. So I think that's a better thing here. But I think it's a very fine line between this and seriously violating ordinary people's privacy. Anyway, that is all that we have time for today. So thank you very much for listening.
Wait, we need to say one more thing. South African woman had 10 babies. So we now have the world record for the most babies for one woman. Amazing. It's terrifying.
Yeah, there was a lady from Tembisa who in a Pretoria hospital gave birth to 10 children in one go. They thought she was going to give birth to 8, and then they found another 2 in there. So congratulations to her. And good luck to her and her husband. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening and have a wonderful day. Cheers, everyone.